Well, this morning, briefly, we're going to look at what the wise men said to Herod in Matthew chapter 2, verse 2. Well, we've seen his star in the east. Here it is. And we have come to worship him. We have come to worship him. That's as clear a statement of intent as you'll find anywhere. That's their declaration. They acknowledge it, confess it before Herod, and that is what we then find them doing later on, as we see in verse 11 there, that they fell down and worshipped him. That's what they knew they were come to do. That was what their mission was. It wasn't a sightseeing tour of Judea, not a kind of mystery tour, follow the star. They knew exactly whom they were looking for, and they knew exactly what they should do when they found him. And they brought gifts that were appropriate to one of high office, great dignity. We have come to worship him. Wise men indeed, and wise people still to this very day, would, when beholding him, say, yes, we have come to worship him. That's what we've come to do. Today, we've come to worship him. We'll be worshiping him tomorrow and Monday, though we won't be perhaps here in this building as the gathered church, won't be the assembly of the righteous. Nevertheless, we are wise if still we are found worshiping him. Wise men, though they were, didn't quite read Herod aright. And this man that they inquired of first of all, the star at that point, was not so visible to them, and they were following their best judgment, but here it led them a little astray, didn't it, that they came to him and didn't understand probably his real heart and real intention, that he declared that he is also going to go and worship him in verse 8. And of course, that was not his desire at all. And there he tried to outwit the wise men. And I guess did, because they needed later on, we would have read, to be warned in a dream, not to go back to Herod, but to depart another way, because Herod's intentions were absolutely murderous. And what a heavy, heavy heart it is that we read the slaughter of all the children under the age of 2 in and around the region of Bethlehem. But for us to remain somewhat on the positive here, and with the words of the wise men ringing in our ears, they knew, and I hope we know, that this person that we have before us, who supplies what Christmas really is to be worshipped. And Christmas is an invitation, as is every other day, actually. But in terms of where society is, or where our culture is, well, here is the great invitation to worship. An invitation that many, no, most, don't take the opportunity to follow up with. Well, first heading, and we're just really looking here and parsing somewhat this statement, we've come to worship him. Well, the first heading is we, the wise men, we, those of us here, whether it was three, whether it was more than three, there they were, plural, a plural we. And, well, there is, isn't there, always a company that the Lord has, a two or a three, us gathered here. He gathered with us in the midst, because he calls worshippers, doesn't he, from all over and everywhere. Backgrounds, cultures, which make up the we, the gathering together of his people. And though at times the number can be very small, what makes up the we can be extremely small, the two or the three. In other places today, there'll be far, far more than that. Maybe not in our culture, maybe not people of primarily our background, but other places where God is working more powerfully than here. Countries, many of which not had anything like the advantages, benefits, heritage that we have had. Interventions of God, translations of Bibles, writings of hymns and good religious books. Haven't had that. And yet today, those are the places where the we have come to worship him will be more significantly fulfilled. But that through history, that we have come, those who have been amongst that number, been all kinds of peoples, haven't they? Wise men, nobles, kings, emperors, ordinary people, people of no great significance or influence in society, but all of them have been brought together, leveled, if you like, all united, all one, all a complete, total we, because of what Christ has done, and they've come to worship. And still today calls all nations, all peoples to come to worship him, and then be able to say, yes, we have come to worship him. Whenever we come into this house of the Lord, it's as if we're stating, yes, we have come to worship him. Whether we're hobbling, whether we're coming with ill health and dislocated shoulders, broken arms, whatever else it might be, yes, we have come to worship him. Well, the second part, have come. Yes, because we didn't start here, did we? Wise men made their journey from the remnants of the Persian Empire, we rather imagine, and they still had a little way to go, 7 miles or so perhaps, to get from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. They've come, not here at this point to the right place or the right person to guide them. Herod consulted with the scribes and chief priests, who of course did come up with the answer that was needed, Micah chapter 5 and verse 2. But we have to make a journey in order to worship. We have to come from somewhere different if we are going to be worshippers. Because worship requires of us change of perspective, change of location, if you like, and the removal, loss maybe, of comforts, dignities, and perhaps familiarity, in order that we should come and worship him. The wise men had made a difficult journey, not an easy journey, one that was lacking in any risk or difficulty, not far from it. They risked being robbed, they risked being maybe ridiculed at home for leaving the comforts, maybe, of wherever they lived in Persia to go to this obscure country of no great significance in the eyes of the so-called wise people in Persia. They denied themselves, perhaps, that, allowed their reputations to be somewhat brought into disrepute because of this journey that they are undertaking, following a star, which other people couldn't see, and wondering, frankly, maybe at their sanity for doing what they were doing. But do it, they would. Maybe they lived a degree of comfort, maybe even luxury, where they were. But now they were very happy to find their way eventually from Herod's palace to the proper location where the one that they would worship was situated, coming to the house. By now, we imagine, maybe this is a fair few months on, actually, from the events of Luke chapter 2, that they come to the house, an ordinary house. But we don't read that they stumble at that they kind of puzzled. Well, what are we doing here? This sort of rather ordinary address, this rather ordinary looking house. This is perhaps where a king is to be, where we're bringing our gold, our frankincense, and our myrrh. We, you know, the kinds of streets, I guess, that we live in, that, you know, you get the knock on the door, don't you, now, and the delivery man's left it there on the doorstep and gesture to you that there it is, and there's your box or whatever it is from Amazon or somewhere else, and fill up your recycling bin with all the cardboard that it produces. But our kinds of addresses, not the places where you get the knock at the door, the delivery man's just left you some gold there or frankincense or myrrh on your doorstep, ordinary houses. And this was an ordinary place that they had come, denying perhaps themselves something of their dignity and high office we found there, because they'd seen past all that and they'd seen the person that they were seeking above all others. That's what we have to do if we're to worship, that we travel. We travel in our thinking. We change places, pride, our own thoughts of status and who we are, and we forsake all of that, that we will come on wet winter days. We will sit in rather drafty, chilly rooms because we've come to worship. We've forsaken the comforts and warmth, maybe, of our own homes to be sat here. You can look at the temperature afterwards there on the reading on the wall, but it won't be a reading too high. I can assure you, you probably could tell me that anyway. So we put things, the worship of God, higher than our own comforts. And it always requires that. Worship, not about making money, not about making the right connections in church, not about getting respectability, as if culture these days would afford us that, not about networking, not about tradition either, not something that we kind of do because it's written into the kind of cultural fabric of who we are as a nation, the sort of cultural capital of what once was our Christianity and the hangover of it, holdover from it, still there when people sing carols. Wouldn't sing anything else any other time of the year, perhaps other than Easter, maybe if they go to a funeral or a wedding, but they sing carols. But the words are somewhat lost on them and don't carry the significance that they had to the Wesleys and the people that wrote these hymns those years ago. So we have come. We have denied ourselves to come and worship. We have made this day somewhat special in that way beyond Sunday, to leave other things, to come and worship the living God. Third heading, well, it's the word worship. That word worship, that offering of ourselves to him, that bringing low our own thoughts about how this should be done and our conforming to what he is, God of great power and glory, a God of great reverence and dignity, and to whom we come. We feel it indeed imperative that we should come and worship him ourselves, though it is a habit we have to get out of as we grow as Christians, get away from the obsession with ourselves, with our own idols, and often it's ourselves that is the idol above all idols. It takes a long time to dislodge that one, and we chip away at it, don't we, through our Christian life. But we bow down, and it's in our heart to bow down to him, to draw near to him, to stoop, to kiss him in that way. They're the wise men. They fall down. That is their respect that they show. Whatever their dignity, they recognize they're in the presence of one more dignified. No, as a baby, couldn't respond to them, couldn't even smile to them perhaps at that point. Who can say? But they knew that it was proper to show love and adoration by falling down. That word for worship means to stoop to kiss, to show our affection, our loyalty, to show to that one who is superior to us that we consign our own pride to the dust and that we esteem and hold him in the highest regard and the highest affection. And it requires of us much training to do it. We have to train our affections and our senses. We have to master our wayward thoughts and our own tendencies to make our own idols and our own images and learn to pour out our hearts to him. In the end, good food, though, I hope we are going to enjoy over this period, perhaps some time that we may yet have with family. Well, who can say? But that's not what we're living for. That's not what Christmas is. It may have a bit of that, and sure, there's a place for that. But it's not about that. It's not about our goods and how many we have and how few we have, and we're worrying about that. We're not living for our fame, our reputation, our achievements, or our talents. We are living for him. We are preoccupied with him. Worshippers are preoccupied. They have their minds filled with somebody else. They have their thoughts habitually turning toward him. And often in that worship, there may be a degree of conflict because we feel very sad that others have not come to worship him. It's not because of friends who are having to shield or isolate or duties call them aside, or they simply can't get here because they haven't got the transport. But we look at our neighbours, don't we? We look at the streets we live in, and they haven't come, have they, to worship him. There's something more important for them, something extra. I guess many of them might make that educated guess. They won't be here either tomorrow morning or the next Sunday morning, unless something remarkable begins to stir in our nation. But we're preoccupied with him. Worship means we want to know, what does he want? How can we know him better? How can we understand him more thoroughly? How can we go away from that act of worship we do when we particularly gather together in one place and translate that then into our everyday life to show that we're living for the glory of God, that we hold him up and say to other people, you hold him up, let the Lord be magnified, as we read in Psalm 40. So that should be our wonderful absorption. We are taken up in him. His honor, his glory, beauty and supremacy, all the things that he displays in perfect harmony, like his justice and his holiness and his wisdom, his truth and his mercy. But we note, there is Herod. He is going to worship him also. Is he just? He is not going to stoop near to kiss. He is going to come to kill. And sadly, so much that is called worship is more destructive than it is helpful, is less honouring to God than it is dishonouring to him. And so we are careful and thoughtful about what we call worship, what we do when we worship, that it may, at least as far as sinful human beings can, with our distracted minds, with our divided hearts, and at least begin to approximate what it should be when we worship. Well, my final word, fourthly, him. Him. And just as it has been about him, that is how it remains. There's no other person to worship but him. There, though in his infancy, Word incarnate, God who's come in the flesh, and because he's come in the flesh, so he must live what it means to live in the flesh, not arrive fully formed as a 30-year-old, but to begin where we all begin, in that way, in the womb, and then coming out into the world, being delivered, and then having to grow up, be not excused the things, the dignities, if you like, of being a baby, of growing up as a child, obedient to his earthly parents. But this is what we have to do with, isn't it? The religions of the world struggle with this. How can this be that God, all his infinite wonder and immensity of being, should now be contracted to a span? That somehow in this person that we are regarding here, we are seeing man and at the same time seeing God, seeing the one who has revealed himself to us in this particular humbling fashion. And yet he does. And that's the whole heart, isn't it, that the Christian religion sets it apart from any other religion in the world. Because here is God coming among us to do the very thing that we could not do, and to be born among us, in order that he might live among us, Emmanuel, God with us, and that he might, in the end, of course, die among us, die for us, die in that body here, which so innocent in that way, so needing mother, needing support, needing help, needing all that mothers, fathers provide for little babies. You see them, don't you, there? And on the train the other week, and there was a mum with a very little baby in a pram, and hey, you find yourself smiling. Well, wasted time, I had a mask on, didn't I, there? And so much the tragedy of wearing masks that children can't quite see that we're smiling at them. There the little baby was, and as little babies do, their arms sort of up there, aren't they, as they're lying there. And that was the same for our Lord Jesus too. Would have been like that. And what a wonder that that is. And then as a toddler, be with his parents, and even as a toddler, we might well imagine, subject to tantrums indeed, but admonishing parents, I'm sure, in what was suitable for a 2-3-year-old, trusting God, and look to God. So we can see him growing up in that way, the one dependent on his mother for everything, and yet actually the one who is giving everything that his mother needed. The one who is receiving life, but yet also at the same time, the one who is giving life. And there is the diametrically opposed sort of things that we bring together and that make us wonder at Christmas most especially, but should make us wonder at every time and all times. Growing up as he did, and coming into adulthood, imagine him somehow detached and aloof and out of touch with what's happening around him. How else do you think that he was able to speak the parables that he did? How else do you think that he had illustrations to hand unless he was fully embedded in the culture of Nazareth, knew what made people tick there, saw it, knew it? He knew about fatted calves and great happenings and big family events and weddings. He'd been to them. He was part of that society. And yet within it, knowing that he belonged on the cross, finally, not the comfort of home, not to stay in that society there, that his own mission, and indeed his sinlessness, did bring distance, did mean that he was always looking on it differently, always knowing that ahead of him there was that appointment to be kept at the cross. At Psalm 40, there he is, a body prepared for him, one who had come to do the will of God, who delighted to do it, and the law of God was in his heart in a way it had been in no other human's heart who had ever walked the face of the earth before or since. And though he was they're part of his community, part of that whole culture and whole life of first century Judea. He was to be finally alone on the cross, deserted, not to have people coming from afar to worship him there, but denied friendship, comfort, having people shouting at him more like the Herods who had come, not the wise men who were there. Deserted too, and finally, of course, cut off even from his father and having to suffer what it meant to be a sinner, regarded as such, treated as such, to receive the wrath of God as such. But of course, risen, his manhood there restored in full, now glorified, transformed, and then taken up into glory. And all that is his now is one day to be ours too. So that's him, a whole Christ, a real Christ, not a Christ that is removed from us, but is with us, not a Christ who knows nothing of what it means to be a human being, but knows everything about being a human being, yet of course without sin, and who is still there now at the right hand of God, not having forgotten what it meant, not having forgotten what it's like for children, what it's like for older people, even though he himself didn't have to go into old age, knowing what it's like for us in the pressures of family life and the pressures of work, all that it thrusts upon us, the pressures of being young, the pressures of being old. And thus we rejoice today. We worship a whole Christ, the God-man, God and man, yet without losing anything of what it means to be both God and man in one person at the same time. And so we have what the world does not have, stumbles over it, struggles with this. How does this logically work? Oh, we're dealing with wonderful truth, God's truth, God's son. Should we not wonder if we did actually have the ability to explain it all precisely, to apply this here and see how that works there? Friends, we're out of our depth. wondrously and gloriously so, happily so. And may the wonder of this one that the wise men came to worship be at the center of our souls to animate us and be our delight, that we may, if we have not yet found him, be our Savior, find him today. Oh, yes, of all days, best of days. Know the blessings of our sin forgiven, what he came to do, that we might be elevated, raised up out of miry clay and horrible pits, and put on rock and have a song of praise in our mouth to God. Or may that be our experience today and always as we come to sing our last hymn this morning.